Welcome, everybody, to Jawanza for Life, also known as Health, Wealth, and Divine. It's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon. To all of you entrepreneurs out there, new entrepreneurs out there, I just want to say hello and welcome. I've got a show for you. I've got a treat for you. And for all of you entrepreneurs out there, you know that starting a business, running a business, you know, being in charge of a business and all that comes along with that, there's a lot involved in it. It's not as simple as just getting an idea and just waking up the next day and saying, I'm going to do this, and then going out there and doing it without learning a few valuable lessons along the way. Well, again, I've got a treat for you today. If you've been following the show for a while, you know that once a month we have a special guest. This is our entrepreneurial segment of Health, Wealth, and Divine. And I just want to say that you have really blessed to be able to have at your disposal somebody with over 50 years of business experience, entrepreneurship experience, and not just in one particular area, but in many different areas of business, and knows the ins and the outs of business. And with over 50 years of experience, we are very fortunate to have as our special guest today Professor Joseph T. Geiger. He's an entrepreneur extraordinaire. He is an author. And let me tell you a little bit about him in case you're just tuning in for the very first time. Currently retired, Professor Geiger, Joseph Geiger, grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. Over his lifetime, he has started over 10 businesses, two of which predated his college graduation. And after his second retirement, he taught entrepreneurship and small business management. In order to help people like us succeed in business, he wrote Entrepreneurial Success, 103 Practical Business Principles, The Road to the Top. Professor Geiger now lectures and teaches seminars at the University of Richmond, located in Richmond, Virginia, where he currently resides. And as I mentioned, he has over 50 years' experience as an entrepreneur. And we're going to tell you how you can get this great book. I mean, if you're just tuning in for the first time, as I mentioned, he's an author of a fabulous book that you've got to have. You know, people always say, you've heard the term, oh, you got to have this book in your library. No, you don't need to have it in your library. You need to have it on your desk. I mean, just right in front of you. This is not a book that you just buy and stick up on the shelf next to the other books that you haven't read in years. This is a book, a very practical book that you can read and, you know, can really, really assist you in your business and in life. There are life principles as well. So very, very fortunate to be able to bring to you my guest for the evening, Joseph T. Geiger, entrepreneur extraordinaire. Welcome back to Health, Wealth, and Divine. Great to have you.
Thank you very much, Jawanza.
You know, as I mentioned to the listeners, we've been going through the book chapter by chapter, principle by principle. You can't get, I just want to thank you again for this book, because you can't get a better opportunity, I'm speaking to the listeners now, to have somebody just almost like literally take you by the hand and walk you through the principles that they've learned in over 50 years of experience as an entrepreneur. You know, there'll be times when, if you haven't gotten the book, I'm sure you already know entrepreneurs out there that you've run across situations and you found yourself saying, you know, dang, if I'd have known this, you know, if I'd have just known that, you know, I didn't know this, you know. Well, this book can actually save you a lot of time, it can save you a lot of headaches, and save you a lot of money if you follow the instructions and follow the principles outlined in the book. So, as I mentioned, we're going through the book, principle by principle, chapter by chapter. If you're tuning in and you've been following us along, you know we left off on chapter 8. And today we're going to be starting with principle number 60. But you know what? Before we do that, If I may, Professor, there are always people who always want to know, you know, when you're interviewing somebody, well, what makes them the expert? Why am I listening to them? Could you tell people a little bit about your background in business so that they know why they're listening to you? What got you started as an entrepreneur?
Well, I really don't know, because I started at such a young age. I started when I was in high school, and I saw an opportunity that I'm dyslexic, which means that I have a very hard time reading. I read very slowly. Fortunately, I remember what I read pretty well, but I still read slowly. And so my parents had sent me away to a school that specialized in that. And at the school, I found there was an opportunity to supply the Sunday New York Times newspaper. The school was in the eastern part of the U.S., and nobody was doing that. So I found out who the distributor was, and I didn't have any money, so I talked them into giving me so many papers, and then I would pay them 1 week behind. So and they did that, and I got students to subscribe to it, and I would deliver the paper once a week. And so it worked out pretty well, because they all wanted it. There was a lot of pretty well-to-do students there, and so I was the only one that had essentially a job, and mine was to deliver papers. So that was the first one, and it was just there was an opportunity. People were talking about my peers, the students would say, gee, I wish we had the New York Times, because I like to watch, I like to read something, you know, maybe it was the sports or the funnies or whatever it was. But so that was the first one. And after that, things would just happen. People would say something to me. The second was when I was in college. I was fishing in Colorado. And a guy on a river at night in the late afternoon asked me how I was catching all the fish, and I was using some little very very tiny trout flies that I had made myself, and he offered me $10 for them, and that's when, I mean, goodness, this is 60 years ago, and $10 was a lot of money then. I mean, that was goodness, it was just a lot of money. So I got into that one in the same way, because there was somebody said, gee, would you sell me some and would you do something? And sure, I'd grown up on a farm, and I had been trained as a young person that when you saw something that needed to be done, go do it. And this was sort of the same way. And the reason, the only difference between, I think, my book and many others is when I started teaching, and I had textbooks on business, the one fault that I found in virtually all of them was that the authors would tell people the theory of things, but they didn't really tell anybody how to do it. And if they did, what they said, their principles were pretty ethereal. And a good example is that in the chapter on advertising, they might say, well, if you have the kind of business that a roadside sign would work, you need to do a sign that people will notice and they'll look at and they'll know where you are. And that's the kind of sign to make it very noticeable. Well, how do you actually do that? I mean, can you execute that kind of instruction? And the answer is no. So what can you execute? So my theory or my principle on the same thing is you're allowed to have one picture and seven words on your roadside sign. And so can you do that? Well, of course you can. You can pick a picture and you can write seven words, not eight, not nine, not ten, but seven. You can have it less than that, but not more than that. And it'll be read. So the whole book is the 102 principles. Virtually every single one of them is an executable principle. And you read the principle, you read the commentary about it, understand what it is, and it is executable. And that is what is lacking in most books, is the principles that are given are not executable. You can't really do them. So that's the difference.
You know, Professor, I inadvertently said 103 principles. I guess I'm already waiting for the next edition. You know, because I want to tell everybody, this book, if you're an entrepreneur, you will definitely gain so much from this book. I mean, again, not just from a business standpoint, but I found myself even using some of the principles in life. One of my favorite principles is, what's the downside? You know, it's a business principle, but it's also a life principle, and there are many others that you'll be able to benefit from. So again, we'll tell you how you can get this great book before the show is over. So again, we're going through the book chapter by chapter, principle by principle, and we're going to kick it off this evening with the principle, if your cash flow forecast finds a financial problem, guess what? You have found a business problem. Professor?
Well, that really comes from you in a lot of books you hear the other side of it. You hear people say that business problems very often turn into financial problems. So I just reversed it, because that when they say that, that's kind of after the fact. So you have a business problem and it turns into a financial problem. It's a little late now. Wouldn't it be nice if you could figure out that you have a business problem coming at you? Well, how do you find that? What is the principle that you can actually execute? Well, if you do a cash flow forecast, which every good business should operate, whether you're a startup or you've been at it for 30 years, you should operate your business off of a cash flow forecast that's part of a business plan. It's about half of a business plan for a startup, and it's probably three quarters of a of the business plan for a going business. So the principle is that as you go through, if you run across a situation where your cash flow forecast says, hey, our cash is dropping, it's going down, it's going in the wrong direction, maybe you shouldn't say, well, what should we do to turn that around? You should ask, why is it dropping? Do I have a business problem buried in there that I didn't see? And that's what's running us out of cash. So it's the flip side of the common one, which says if you have a business problem, it will probably turn into a cash flow problem, that you're running out of money. The principle here, my principle, is let's discover that before it happens. And the way you discover it is when you're doing your cash flow forecast, if you notice that cash is getting tight for some reason, you better discover why. And probably what it is, it's a business problem that's buried in there that you didn't see. And this allows you to see it before it happens.
You know, Professor, if we can, before we go to the next principle, if we could just talk about details for a moment, because even as you were sharing the principle, you know, it came to me that one of the reasons why a lot of people probably aren't entrepreneurs or shy away from that, because of the responsibility involved. There are a lot of details involved in being an entrepreneur, like keeping a cash flow forecast, you know. I mean, you have to be about the details, you know. And for a lot of people, you know, they would just much rather just, you know, go to work, you know, give me my 9 to 5 every 2 weeks, give me my check. I know what I got to do. I don't have to worry about the details that the owner of the company has to worry about. It's just so much simpler to just, you know, go to work, tell me what to do, I'll do it, give me my money, I'll go home, see you next week, you know. But if you're going to be an entrepreneur, you're not going to avoid details if you want to run a successful business. Could you talk about that, Professor?
Yeah, it's one of the, in my classes when I teach business planning, I use an example of a Ford auto dealership. And I tell people that a Ford car company, a Ford dealership, does not sell cars. A Ford dealership sells F-150 trucks. They sell Mustangs. They sell Tierras. They sell particular specific cars, just like a dress shop does not sell dresses. They sell specific brands of dresses in specific sizes. So the way you do a business plan and for sure a cash flow forecast, again, for the car agency, you decide in advance how many Mustangs are you going to sell in January and how many F-150s and how many Tauruses and so on. And the same in February and the same in March. And if you had a dress shop, you would do the same thing. How many dresses of a particular brand and a particular size are you going to sell in January? And how many in February and how many in March? And if you do it that way, and then as you go through the time of actually executing this, you match up every darn week how you're doing against how you forecast. And if you see that your forecast is not in sync with the facts on the ground, well, you better figure out how, and you better do it pretty quickly. The problem with many, many forecasts is what they do is they say we're in the car business and we're going to sell $1 million worth of cars in January. Well, come January, and you sell $800,000 worth of cars. Well, that's interesting knowledge, but that doesn't help you very much in your inventory. What you need to know is, are you selling the number of Thunderbirds and the number of F-150s that you forecast? And if you're not, then you better make adjustments, and you better do it quick. Otherwise, what's going to happen is you'll run out of the ones you are selling, and you'll have an overabundance of the ones you're not. And the only way you can do that is get down in the weeds into the details. The more detailed you are, the more likely your cash flow forecast will be accurate. And if it isn't accurate, you can do something about it. It must be executable. And if it's not executable, it's not worth doing.
Well, you know, Professor, let me ask you this. And again, this is for the listeners out there, because there might be people that, you know, have this question. And the role, if you could talk about then even just the role of that the economy plays in these forecasts. You know, there are a lot of people, some companies might even have an in-house economist on staff that can, you know, kind of look and project and extrapolate, and look at the numbers and, you know, see where the economy is. Because, for example, you might take somebody like, you know, myself and my wife, we're in the real estate. And so there are times when it's a down market, you know, and or it could be you could be in a cyclical business, you know, where, you know, certain times of the year things tend to pick up, you know, other times things tend to wane, you know. But then if, for example, the economy is going through a turbulent time, then they're going to have to be some adjustments made to the forecast. Could you talk about people being flexible even in their forecasting, because things just don't always work out as you might have forecasted?
Well, quite frankly, things seldom work out as you forecast. You'll just be wrong in areas. Hopefully, you'll never be terribly wrong, but certainly if you were in the real estate business in 2007 and 2008, there was an awful lot of people who found out they were terribly wrong. And in that business, if you're a builder, you've got to forecast well ahead of time, because you don't start a house on Monday and it's ready to sell on Friday. You know, mm-hmm. it just takes some time. And it's one of the reasons that I keep preaching to people that you need to be very specific, or as specific as you possibly can, and then you need to execute your plan on a virtually a daily basis. So I would do, when I was in business, I would do cash flow forecasts that were monthly, and then the last of the month, I would break the coming month down into weeks. And then every Friday, I would try to take what I had forecasted, what we had done, we were going to do on the coming week, and break it down into days. What were we actually going to do on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and so on. And you start out your week, and then midweek you would see how you're doing. Are you on schedule? And if you do it that way, then, and let's say you're a builder, and all of a sudden in 2007, you see that, hey, you're not, things aren't selling pretty well. You're having, your suppliers are offering you deals on refrigerators and other stuff. Well, why are they doing that? Well, they got it wrong. That's why. Well, if they got it wrong, did I get it wrong? And if they got it wrong in the number of refrigerators, so they're trying to unload refrigerators on me for my houses, maybe there's a lesson in here, buried in here, and I better listen to them. So if you do this in detail, you find where you are wrong as early as possible, and hopefully you find it earlier than others. If you're in the real estate business, you listen very carefully about how lenders are offering to finance buyers of real estate. And if you hear lenders saying, well, get an appraisal on the house that you're looking at buying, whether it's new or used, and we will lend 100%. I can remember I was in California when they were offering 105 and 110%. And a lot of people thought, boy, this is wonderful. Well, not if you're in the real estate business, it isn't wonderful. It's wonderful today. But what it's telling you is that you are fixing the crash, because that sort of thing cannot maintain itself. And so it's a big red flag up there. The smart ones, when that happened in the real estate business, said to themselves, well, fine, I'm going to ride this horse as long as I can, but I'll tell you one thing for sure, I'm not going to have any inventory, because this sucker is going to crash, and when it does, it's going to crash bad. Now, I am, to bring this home right now, every so often on television, I hear ads right now that say, we will finance 100% of your real estate, your house. And if I was in the real estate business, I would be trimming my inventory, because that isn't going to last. At some point, it's going to crash, because that sort of thing is not sustainable. So if you do a good cash flow forecast, and then you work it every day, and you ask yourself, if I'm off on something, why am I off? Did I just kind of get it wrong, or is the economy changing? Maybe it's getting better, and maybe it's not. So you keep asking yourself those questions, and you will get answers before the average bear gets answers, and you'll be able to do something about it.
You know, you made a very strong point to watch the signs. Watch the signs. Just back to real estate for a second. I remember when before the crash, there were a lot of builders out there that overbuilt. I mean, they got stuck with a whole bunch of product, man, and they couldn't move, man, and they just were just lost all kinds of money, just because they broke. Like you.
Yep.
Yeah. you know,
yeah,
wanting to ride the horse.
They saw the good times, and they didn't ask themselves, why is it so good? Why are there so many people coming in? Well, people are being able to get loans for houses who really can't afford the houses. And this was great. A lot of people say, well, this was great for people with not a whole lot of money. They were able to get 100% loan, sometimes 105% loan, to get a house. Well, people with limited assets, limited income, they don't need more debt. They need more income. And when you see this happening, you should say to yourself, wow, this thing is not sustainable. This is going to crash. And I don't care whether you're talking about houses or pantyhose. It is not sustainable. When things are doing that, you should think to yourself, maybe I'd better be careful. Maybe I'd better be a little more conservative on what I do. And if I miss a sale or two, so be it. But I'm also going to survive when the others don't.
Everybody, my special guest is, I call him Professor Joseph Geiger, Joseph T. Geiger, author of the fabulous book, Entrepreneurial Success, 102 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. Again, we're going through the book chapter by chapter, principle by principle. If you're listening online, the call-in number is 347-324-5727. And if you are listening by phone, just press 1 and I'll bring you on and you can make your comment or ask your question. Okay, so let's moving right along to the next principle. I'm reading from principle 61 is add value to your product or service. Add value to your product or service. Professor?
Well, let me kind of talk about the flip side of that. People will tell you all the time, if you're a little guy, you need to be able to sell for less. I don't agree with that at all. I think you need to sell more. And I don't mean more quantity. I mean more quality, more of what people want. And the reason is, if you're competing in the, let's say you're selling shoes or you're manufacturing shoes, the big manufacturers can always outprice you. I mean, if you're selling dresses, we'll go back to that one, and you're a small company, I'll guarantee you that Walmart can sell dresses for less than you can. And they could give the damn things away if they want to and bury you. You'll go broke. They won't because they got all kinds of other stuff that they're doing. And they're big and they're established. They have big lines of credit. And if they lose $1 million, so what? If you lose $10,000, it may be curtains. So what they can't do, what the big guy can't do, is to add value. And you ask me, well, what do you mean by that? I'll give you one that we all know about. The first automobile that I bought had a stick shift and crank up windows, and it didn't have a radio, it certainly didn't have a stereo, didn't have air conditioning, didn't have all kinds of things. You look at what they're doing now. And what people are doing now is they're adding trinkets to their automobiles. I have a Dodge truck, and I recently priced a new Dodge truck. I could get a new one, kind of equipped the way I have it, for $25,000. I could get a new one with all the bells and whistles for, I think it was $61,000. Same damn truck. Same chassis, same everything, except the new one had a big engine and four doors and a fancy leather interior and, God, just on and on and on, electric windows that would go up and down when it got hot or cold all by themselves, you know, whatever. The Dodge loves people who do that, because if you buy a stripped-down work truck, they're lucky to make a bare profit on that. If they sell you a $25,000 truck, they're probably damn lucky to make $1,000. But if you buy that same truck and you spend $62,000, they're going to make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't going to make $1,000. They'll probably make $10,000 or $12,000, way, way more money. And so they want to do that. Well, if you're a manufacturer or a small business, what you should try to do is to offer more value for what you're selling, not at a lower price, because the big guys can always match your price. They can always beat your price, frankly. But they can't beat your value if you add something to it. So let's say you're in the taking care of people's lawns, and there's a lot of people out there and some big companies that mow lawns. But if you go to your customers and you say, "Well, I'll mow your lawn, but I'll also trim your shrubs, and I'll weed them, and I'll do this little thing and that little thing," well, the big company has a hard time doing that, because they got to reprogram all their people, they got to redo all the pricing, they got to do all kinds of stuff. You could do that in a matter of minutes, something that takes them a month to do, to actually accomplish. And you can get more for your product than your labor, in this case, and your service, than the other guy. So why do people buy stuff? Do you buy things because it is offered at a low price, or do you buy things because you want or need them? I think almost everybody would say you buy it because you want or need it. If somebody would come to me and say, "I have a Rolls Royce that normally sells for $250,000, and I'll sell it to you for $110,000. I don't want the damn thing. I want a truck.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a farm boy. I don't
right.
care what the price is. So it may be the biggest deal ever, but I don't want it." People, you sell things to people because, one, they want it, and two, they can afford it.
Mm-hmm.
So what you try to do, if you're a little guy, is you try to maximize their wants and needs. You try to overperform there, and then the cost is whatever the cost is. So, and people will tell you, "Well, you got to sell for less." If that was true, Mercedes-Benz would still be trying to sell their first car. Because there's nothing less about the price of a Mercedes-Benz.
Mm-hmm.
But they still sell lots of Mercedes, and they make lots and lots of money. It's a very rich company. And
mm-hmm.
one of the reasons is because they charge these horrific prices, but people are willing to pay for it. So don't worry about the price so much as worried about satisfying the customer. If you can satisfy the customer better than your competitor, they will buy from you.
Mm-hmm.
And damn the price, they'll buy from you.
Everybody, words of wisdom. So I want you to know we've got a book full of principles to go, okay? So I want to encourage you, and a matter of fact, now would probably be a good time to tell people how they can get your book, Professor, so that if they're following along, listening to you once a month, they can actually get the book and read along and even read ahead and come back and then hear the in-depth explanations from you. So how can people get this great book, Professor?
Well, you can get it two places. You can get it at Amazon, or you can get it direct from my website. My website is theroadtothetop.com. And if you get it from me, I sign it. You'll get a signed copy, and if you get it from the Amazon, it won't be signed because they didn't write it. I did. So, but the price is the same regardless. And so hopefully you'll send me an email and go online and click on it and buy it. It's just $18, $17.95. And I'm one of these people who I was told I had to make it $17.95, but I always tell everybody it's $18 because that's the way I think. When somebody tells me it's something 95, I always round up. So I think about what it really is. So that's what
there's
it is.
There's a reason people even do that.
Get it.
That one time before, why people even say put the 95 on the end, you know, but maybe that's another discussion. But
yeah,
$17.95, $18.
It's $18, and it's theroadtothetop.com. And you can get it there.
And they can also get a cash flow forecast, correct?
You can get a cash flow forecast. It may seem a little intimidating when you take a look at it. You open it up because it's 26 pages, but it's pretty simple. It's a fill in the blanks. So you don't have to be able to add two and two and reliably get four. You don't have to know anything about accounting. You do have to know when you do it, how much you think you're going to sell in a variety of things. It is done on the basis of a Ford dealership. So if you're not a Ford dealership, but you're a lawn care person, instead of having five different divisions, you only have one. And instead of having the inventory stuff, you don't. So, but it still works. Because you just fill in the blanks, you just got very few blanks to fill in, and it. But it does force you to go through what your costs are, kind of item by item, and it forces you to be thorough. And when you get through, it'll drop out what you're making money or losing money month by month.
You know, everybody, you heard Professor say you can also get the cash flow forecast. Don't let that fool you. You need the cash flow forecast, okay? You know, I know it sounds optional, you know what I mean? But, you know, and technically, you know, it's optional. You don't have to get it, but it would behoove you to get it. Why not get it and pay for the cash flow forecast and then, you know, be glad that you did, because it's much, much better to say I'm glad I did than I wish I had. So just go ahead and get the cash flow forecast when you get the book, okay, because you won't regret it. You'll definitely, it'll pay dividends, okay, so definitely get that. When you get the book, get the cash flow forecast. And get the book from Professor Geiger. That way you can get the signed copy of it, you know, get the autograph. Because truly, you know, we actually look at people and want certain people's autographs. You know, we look at superstars or whatever, and we're happy because, you know, we got them to, I talked to so-and-so, and, you know, they gave me their autograph. But this person, you might just watch them on TV. You know, they might just be your best, you know, sports figure or, you know, musical artist. And other than them entertaining you, they're not doing anything for you. This autograph can pay you dividends, because if you get this autograph, that means that you got the book, okay? So the book is going to definitely help you more than your favorite entertainer's autograph will. So get the book, get the autograph, and get the cash flow forecast. Okay, so moving right along, we're going to the next principle, which is a very, very interesting one. They're all interesting, but don't compete against yourself. Professor, how do people do that? How do people would say, I don't compete against myself. How people do compete against themselves? How do they do that?
Well, let's say that you have a dress shop, and you have been selling three lines of dresses in your dress shop, and you go to another dress shop and you see, well, they have one of the lines you have, but they have two others. So you call up those manufacturers and you order a whole array of dresses from each of those. So now you have five different lines. And sure enough, you go to another place and they have a couple you don't have. And pretty soon you have 8 or 10 different lines of dresses,
mm-hmm.
all trying to sell the same person. And pretty soon you're competing against yourself. You're confusing your customer, and
mm-hmm.
you're making it hard for them to make a decision. So don't do that. If every so often I'll go into hardware store because coming off a farm, I'm interested in tools. And once in a while, I'll see a hardware store that has five different kinds of electric drills, five different makes. Well, what's the difference? Now, granted, there are the ones that are made for home use, and there's the ones that are made for commercial use, and maybe you have one in between. And if you get the three, you probably have it covered. You don't need more of them, and yet people do. You increase your inventory, you end up trying to sell the customer the same thing, and you confuse them. I like to fish and hunt, and I noticed one of the boat manufacturers that make aluminum boats had an aluminum boat in length every foot from 12 feet to 24 feet. And I can't imagine what it must be like if you're selling that for somebody to come and say, well, they want a boat that will seat three people. And so you say, well, you can get a 14-foot, a 15-foot, a 16-foot, a 17. And pretty soon they throw up their hands and they say, hey, I'll see you later. So in that case, you are competing against yourself. Don't do that. Try to figure out what people want and need. You're not going to be able to supply 100% of what everybody needs, but if you can get 80% or so, you're doing pretty good. The other day I was talking to a class about management and trying to set goals. And one of the examples I've used, don't try for the perfect, try for the good. And the best example I know is the Lockheed Skunk Works when they were designing the SR-71, which is far and away the fastest airplane ever built. It had a cruise speed three times as fast as the next closest. What their goal was to get 80% of the possible, and that's what they tried to do, only they tried to do it everywhere. So every little part and piece and design thing, the aerodynamics, the inlets, the engines, all of that, they said to themselves, we'll set a goal of 80% of the possible. And they ended up with an airplane that could cruise well over 2,000 miles an hour and do it for 3,000 miles. And it could fly at over 80,000 feet. Nobody has ever even come close to that. Not even close. They didn't try to get 100%. They tried to get 80%. And if you can do that in your business, in all the things you do, you'll be a success. Just don't try to get the perfect. Don't try to compete against yourself.
Now, let me ask you about that plane for a second. Now, I'm sure I'm guessing that was a passenger plane. People could actually...
No, it was a military airplane. It was a military reconnaissance airplane that the Blackbird is what it was called, is SR-71. And it seated just two people, but it took off from Los Angeles and landed or flew what was going over the top of Washington, D.C. in 1 hour. And a Boeing takes 5 hours to do the same thing. If you flew in, nobody could even come close to that because no airplane can fly over past the speed of sound at cruise. And the SR-71 could fly 3.5 times the speed of sound at cruise. That was their normal cruise speed. And nobody else could come even close. And never have. It was originally built in 1960.
Okay. Oh, wow. That was a long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah, before the computer.
Well, the reason I had asked that was because that could have been one of those situations where they maybe outdid themselves. I mean, just because you do have people that, or companies, manufacturers that might say, okay, well, we'll do this and it can do this. And the customer's like, well, hey, if you can get me there in 3 hours, I'm good. I don't need to get there in an hour and pay, you know, and pay you three times as much as it would cost me to, you know, get there in 3 hours, you know. So,
well, this was a surveillance reconnaissance airplane, and it flew over North Korea, it flew along China, over China, it flew over Russia, flew all over the Mideast. It was shot at with the absolute latest of rockets. And in 30 years, nobody ever hit it. No one ever shot it down. Nobody ever hit it. And what would happen is they would see that the rocket had been fired at them, so they just increased speed. And it didn't make any difference how fast they were going. They could always increase speed, and a lot. So if they were cruising along at 2,300 miles an hour and somebody shot at them, within a minute, they could be at 2,600 miles an hour and accelerating like blazes.
I guess when they're shooting at you, it pays to be able to move fast.
Them. And that's what they did. They'd shoot rockets at them, and they just outrun them.
Wow. See, you tune into Wonderful Life, Health, Wealth, and Divine, and you actually learn, you get a little history lesson as well. Professor Geiger's got a lot of knowledge about a lot of things, and so, again, we encourage you to get this book because it's going to pay dividends for you. Professor, I want to talk about the new book that you have out and how people can get that as well. We have many, many more principles to go. The next one would have been... Entrepreneurs see opportunities, managers see problems. Did you want to try to get that in before we talk about your new book?
Yeah, we can probably do that and then end with a new book.
Okay, great.
And basically that's just what it is. Entrepreneurs see opportunities to meet the needs and wants of people, and managers see all the problems they are. And I'm an entrepreneur. I'm not a very good manager because I don't see the problems. I only see the opportunities. You need both. And occasionally, very occasionally, you'll find somebody who's good at both, but most are not. And so if you're only good at one of them, which is the vast majority of them, you need to partner with somebody who's good at the other. And so when it came to running a production line, I was great at setting it up. I was great at designing the product, but I wasn't great at running it. So I found people who were great at running it. And I told them that when I went and meddled in it, which I would, for them to come to me and in very blunt terms say, get out of here. You're screwing it up. Because I don't want you out there coming up with your bright ideas. They may be better, but there are problems for the manufacturing line because we need to make the same thing over and over again the same way so the quality is the same. And if you want to come up with something different, that's great. Make it for next year's model, but not in my production line. And when I found somebody that way who was good at it, I tried my best to stay out. I usually didn't succeed, but the good ones, I had convinced them to come to me and say, get out of here. And, you know, I learned to do it, and it worked out well. So those are the two things that make a business hum. You have to have an entrepreneur that sees the opportunity, also that sees the change in what is the business climate, and the manager who sees the problems and can solve the problems before they hit. Two very different personalities.
You know, you have some people, Professor, that are very you know, you have different types of bosses. You know, you have some bosses that are very easy to talk to, some bosses that are intimidating. And you might have a situation, and I'm sure that there are people out there that have experienced having a situation where they had a boss that they just didn't feel comfortable telling any bad news to, you know. It's like, you know, you don't want to get on the boss's bad side. Oh, you know, they tremble when the boss is in the room, you know, and don't want to share information that could invariably, you know, help the company, save the company, but for fear of the wrath of the boss, you know, they might not say anything. So I would encourage everybody, if you are an entrepreneur and you're running things, it's your show, don't intimidate your workers to the point where if you do have a manager and this person's job is to keep you informed of, I mean, they have to tell you the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know. So don't create a situation where somebody is actually afraid to tell you the ugly, because the ugly could save your business. Correct?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. I tried to tell all of my managers and other people that what I wanted to hear was the bad news. I didn't care about the good news. The good news was wonderful. I mean, it would show up in the bottom line eventually. But I wanted to hear the bad news. And if I tried to blow them off, I told them, do not allow me to do that. I have a strong personality, and I may do that. But jerk me up short and say, hey, you need to listen to this. This is important. We're getting hurt. So if you're that way, I don't know how to talk to the type of person who doesn't want to hear that the bad news, who's a manager and just refuses to hear it. I don't think there's any hope for that person. But if you have somebody that does that, maybe you could go to them and say, I've got some bad news for you, and I think you ought to hear it because it is going to hurt us and hurt us badly. And then see if it'll jerk them up short. But I understand the problem because I have it, and I just told my people, do not allow me to do that because I may try to do it, but jerk me up short, and here's what you need to say. And they did.
Well, at least you warned them. At least you told them in advance, Professor.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, let's talk about your new book, Professor.
Okay.
We're going to be doing a next week, next Wednesday, everybody, from 7 to 8 with Professor Geiger. Got a surprise for you. Brand new book. Professor still at it, still writing. Professor, can you talk about your book?
Yeah, this book is very, very different. This is a book. It's entitled Finding a Career for Life. It is written for people who anywhere from a junior in high school on up who are looking for a career and maybe don't have one, maybe they think they do, but I think this book will be very, very helpful. It's a little short book. The Entrepreneurial Success is 335 pages. This one's only 75, but it's very intense. So it tries to tell people what areas of the economy are doing good, what are not. I take no position on whether you should go to college or you shouldn't. I tell you what the businesses or the careers that you can go into if you do not have a college education, and what ones are beyond that that you will have to. Try to break it down as to which are good and which aren't. One of the very, very sad things that is happening in this country is young people in particular are being told that if they get a college education and a degree, they therefore will get a job. Unfortunately, that is patently not true in very, very many areas. The NBC Money Magazine, or it wasn't NBC. Let me look it up. Which it's CNN Money Report did a survey a couple of years ago, and they did it for 2 years, and then they quit because the data was exactly the same. And what they found was that college graduates 6 months after graduation, what they found was 41% were working at jobs that did not require a college degree, while another 11% were simply unemployed. In other words, 52% of college graduates had spent 4 years, lots of money, perhaps they were deeply in debt, and they had a job that they were perfectly qualified for when they got out of high school, and maybe they didn't even have to have that.
Wow.
Frankly, they were. It was hard for me even to get that kind of job, because any employer, and I've been one for a long, long time, if I had a job that did not require any kind of education, and I had somebody who came to me with a bachelor's degree in sociology, and they said, well, I have to have a job, and I'll take that job as a janitor, the one thing I knew up front is that next day they're going to be out looking for a job in sociology, and that they were not stayers. So I was a whole lot better off trying to find somebody who wanted to be the janitor and eventually wanted to be in charge of maintaining the whole property. So that's who I wanted to hire. I didn't want the guy with the bachelor's degree. They may be really well qualified, but I knew they weren't stayers. And so what this does is it goes through the various degrees that you can get, and many jobs, some 35 of them, that require no degree at all, but yet have pretty darn good livings that you can make from it. And so I tried to come up with a way to understand that. Also have a short part in it on how to make decisions. One of the things that business people have for ages complained about with colleges is that they would graduate people and they could not make decisions. They had no idea how to do that. So I included the 6 steps in how to make a decision in here, and very, very brief how you do that. I also have a little section on being an entrepreneur. And the reason for that, in the years 2000 to 2011, there were 29 million new Americans. There were 10.7 million new employed Americans, of which of government employers, the jobs in all of government went up by 1.36 million, and in private industry in that period of time, they went down by 1.26 million. So in other words, there was 100,000 new salaried and wage jobs. There were 10.7 million new entrepreneurs.
Wow.
So if you wanted to pick an area that was the most likely to find a career, it was as an entrepreneur. By, 99% of all new jobs were entrepreneurs. What all this data is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it's based on the IRS data, and they call them proprietors. They didn't use the word entrepreneurs, but it's another word for the same thing. So this is what the little book is. And it's very thorough. And there's all kinds of jobs out there that, as a matter of fact, in the 20 most secure jobs, I think it is 5 of those require no college at all. And yet they're the most secure jobs in the country. So can't beat that. But most people don't know about it. Most college kids are getting degrees that if you look at it after they get the degree, what are their chances of a career with that degree? And quite frankly, the answer is very, very poor. Another myth out there is that the higher the degree, the higher the salary. Well, in the 20 highest paid 6-year degrees, or 6 or 7-year degrees, which is everything from an associate degree at a community college up through a PhD, the highest paying of all of those is as a petroleum engineer with a bachelor's degree, a 4-year bachelor's degree. And it beats all the MBAs, it beats all the PhDs, it beats all the master's degrees by a lot. And it's just a bachelor's degree. Yeah, it really is. The one of the poorest chances of getting a job is in psychology. And yet 10% of all the students that graduate from liberal arts schools have a degree in psychology. There are no jobs for a person with a bachelor's degree or even a master's degree in psychology. You have a PhD? Yeah. Primarily teaching, but there's some others too. But bachelor's and master's, you're just kidding yourself. And yet 10% of the students graduating from liberal arts schools, that's the degree they have. And everybody who's knowledgeable in this knows full well that there are no jobs with that degree.
Well, you know what, everybody? We're going to be talking a lot more about this next Wednesday. Professor Geiger is going to be my special guest from 7 to 8 p.m., and we're going to be discussing the book Finding a Career for Life. Don't miss this show. I mean, just what you just shared about the petroleum engineer with a bachelor's degree, that is amazing to me. That, and what's even amazing, what's as amazing, Professor, to me, is that you did this research, you know, to get this specific information. I mean, this is very, very valuable information. How can people get this book? Can they get it by going to the Road to the Top as well?
Yes, they can. It's there, and it's terribly expensive. It's $9.95 plus mailing.
Less $10, everybody.
Yeah, you'll spend more for a full meal at Mickey D's than you will for my book, and my book will save your butt for your whole life.
Oh my God, that is, I mean, just again, Professor, I'm impressed that you actually did this research. This particular area to look at and to research, because this is very, very valuable information. And
I can tell already
that people are going to really be shocked when they see the disparity in wages and, you know, just what you can get as a high school graduate. And a professor is not suggesting to anybody that you don't go to college. He's not suggesting that at all. His doing is basically saying that this is information that you need to know before making that decision to go to college.
Right.
Correct?
It is. And you need to know it before you decide where you want to go or what you want to major in. I break down the best colleges throughout the country and where you can get the information. All kinds, even the best cities. I found the site that had very, very extensive research on the 150 best cities in the country. Richmond, by the way, is number 50. And where you can do that. And I did it all, Juwanta, because I had so many students that came in and they said, I went to college, I have this degree, and I'm getting nowhere, so I came back to learn something about entrepreneurship because I have this degree, I owe all this damn money, and I'm getting nowhere. And I thought, this is sad. This is really sad. And I knew that some of the things that they were being told are just patently not true. We're in the middle of a presidential campaign, and I hear all the time that one of them says, well, we want to fix it so everybody can get a degree from at least the junior college. Well, that's great. what the hell are you going to do with it? I mean, if that's going to be the case, then I want my son to learn how to be the world's best air conditioning or electrician. Because if all of us are sitting in offices, they don't know how to fix cars or fix or air conditioning or all the others. And these folks at today $75 or shortly $150 an hour are going to do real well. So, you know, there are all kinds of opportunities out there, and I take no position whether you ought to go to college or you ought not to, whether you ought to get a degree in petroleum engineering or classical dance. I don't care. But whatever you do, when you start on it, you ought to know what your odds of success, financial success afterwards are, so that you can make an intelligent decision and not come out and say, had I only known. Because if you owe $35,000, which is the standard today, and you're making $175,000 at a petroleum engineer, it's easy to pay off. And if you're making $12,000 as a dance instructor someplace, it's a little tough.
Well, Professor, somebody wants to talk to you before you go. You got a sec?
Sure.
I'm coming to you. I'm going to call the last four digits of your number. 1111, you're on the air with Professor Geiger. Thank you for your call.
Hello.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Okay. Professor, who contributed most to your education about entrepreneurship or marketing? Which authors?
I did.
Okay.
Unfortunately, because when I went to college, I'm 78.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to college, the word entrepreneurship, that word was not in the English lexicon. Maybe in the French lexicon, but it certainly wasn't in the English lexicon. At University of Denver, there was no such course in small business. So I had to learn it the hard way by making very expensive mistakes.
Okay, so outside of those mistakes that you made, did you do any reading, any research about marketing experts, other entrepreneurs such as yourself?
No, because back when I was learning, there was no such thing. You couldn't buy a book. There was nothing out there for the small business. There's all kinds of stuff now, but there wasn't at that time. I mean, you can go to a community college or MIT or Harvard and take a course in entrepreneurship today. But 60
no, I'm
years
not talking
ago,
about,
there wasn't.
I'm not talking about going to college and learning about being an entrepreneur. Did you do any reading of books written by...
Oh, yeah, I've got a whole library now.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
who?
I've got a whole library that I have now. I think, frankly, for somebody getting started, mine's far and away the best just because it gives principles that are actionable. And others don't.
So who are your favorite authors?
I'm looking at it right now and seeing if I can pick out where. I just moved those things around, unfortunately. There's a guy by the name of Peters who wrote with somebody else a couple of books.
Yeah, the Peter Principle. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, well, it wasn't that. His was... oh, come on, Joseph. Where can you find it? Here. At any rate, he wrote several books on successful companies. Here we go. Pull one out. In Search of Excellence. And it's a Harper and Row. And
that's by McCovey, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Thomas J. Peters.
Peters, right. Okay.
And Robert H. Waterman. And it's a great book, but the problem is it tells the story of I think there's 12 big businesses in there, and what their story is is not applicable to anything I have ever done. And that's why I wrote the book that I did, is because I wanted to have a principle that you could actually do. And so that's what I came up with, 102 of them. That's why there's so many, because there's all kinds of situations in business and in life. And if you have a principle you can actually execute, it's really helpful. If it's just kind of a gauzy sort of thing, I'm not so sure how helpful it is. At least it isn't helpful for me.
So can you name two or three of those principles that are in the book?
Sure. I did at the very start, if you want to do a roadside sign, the principle is the rule of seven. You're allowed a picture and seven words. When you're making a decision, decisions should be data-driven. If you don't have data, hard, factual data on it, it's awful hard to make a decision. The next thing you should do is define the problem, then set goals, then come up with a plan, then do a cash flow forecast to see if you have the cash to execute the plan, and lastly, execute it daily. So that's how you make decisions, those six principles.
Okay. So if I wanted to start a business, what would you suggest I do? I have, let's say, $100,000, and I want to be fairly sure that I'm going to make a profit by the first year, but I'd be willing to forego the profit in the first year if I see it growing fast enough.
Well, you're making a bad mistake there. First, a business is a profitable enterprise. What I say in it, a business is a profit machine, not a sewing machine. It's not a bunch of parts. It's to make a profit. And most small businesses should make a profit certainly within 6 months. Occasionally mine have taken a little longer. Many of them have taken much less. So first you find a opportunity. Then you do some research on it to find out, is there really a market that I can do this with? Then you write a business plan. If you want to have a good one, go to SCORE, score.org, SCORE.org. And it's a national organization of retired executives. They have a super-duper business plan for startups. They have a good one in there for others. And then you can go to my website for a cash flow forecast. They have one that they use, but in my view, it's just way too damn general. I want to be way more specific. When something goes wrong, I want to know why it's going wrong and not that, hey, we got something going wrong. We're not making our sales.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I
think projections should be more as specific as possible.
Yep.
How does one know when one's projections are actually accurate?
You don't. You know when you make your projections, and then every week and certainly every month, you compare with the facts on the ground with your projections. But there's no way to know ahead of time because you don't know what the facts on the ground will be. You do the very best you can. You be as specific as you can, and then you look at the facts on the ground, and do they match up with what you're doing? Are you selling the 10 F-150s that you projected every month? And if what you're doing is you're only selling three of those, but you're selling 15 something else. Well, then you got part of it wrong, and now you know what you got wrong, and you can make an adjustment.
So you don't really know what the projections would be. You just come up with a number and see.
Oh, no. When you have to make projections based on small facts, you'll get pretty accurate on them. Because I'm not saying that, again, let's say we're doing a car agency. I'm not saying that you pick out of the air, well, I'm going to sell $1 million worth of cars in January and $1.1 million in February and so on. That's not helpful at all. How many Ford 150s are you going to sell? How many Mustangs are you going to sell? How many Torrents are you going to sell? And so on.
Yeah, that's a $64,000 question.
Well,
so how do you come up with a figure?
Break it down into little tiny increments, you're going to get more accurate. It just forces you to get more accurate.
You'll break it down into tiny increments, though. But you're saying, okay, you don't really know what the major projections are going to be, so you're going to break it down into smaller increments.
And you will eventually, when you add them all up, you'll find out what the
by trial and error.
And when you get through with it and you look at it and it says, well, I'm going to, according to this, I'm going to sell $5 million worth of cars in February, you say, whoa, I don't think so. This doesn't make sense. I got all carried away here. So let's go back and see what where we really are. And when you do it that way, the mistake people make is they make broad generalizations. They make wild-ass guesses. And then you don't really know what you've done wrong. When you break down to little tiny increments, it's a lot easier to say that, for example, my electric bill in June is going to be so much, and in May it will be a little less, and in August it'll be perhaps a little more. You're able to do that, but if you say, well, my overhead will be $50,000, oh, really? How the hell do you know that? But when you break it down into little increments, you'll find that you'll get a lot more accurate. It just forces you to do it.
To break what down, the expenses or the projections?
Both the expenses, both on the income side and the expense side.
Okay, well, that's easy. About the expenses are relatively easy if you're going to open up. I'm a small business. The projections, though, how do you know? Are you breaking what down into small increments? How do you know you are going to sell that which you want to sell?
Well, there's you can research it and find out whether you can get information on various industries. And let's say you're doing a restaurant and you pick a pizza restaurant, and it's pretty easy to get some information. Now, just because the industry norm is $1 million a year, it doesn't mean you're going to do $1 million a year. But if your projections show that you're going to sell $3 million a year, then you should go back and say, how am I so much better than others? I don't think I will be. And see what I did wrong.
False projections then. Of course, if the average is about $1 million and you're a brand new pizza place and maybe you've never even thrown up a pizza dough in the air ever, then, saying $3 million a year, that's just a wish list.
That's right. And that's what too many of them are. They're wild-ass guest lists, and you don't want to do that. And I'm just telling you, if you do it my way, you do it where you break it down as carefully as you can into small increments, you'll have the odds of you making a good decision, a good estimate, are much, much higher.
All right. Can you give me an example? Because you brought out the pizza place. Now, breaking what down with regards to the pizza place to make it small projections, which could be rational, maybe easily attained. How would you do that?
Well, I would research pizza places and find out what they sell.
Mm-hmm.
And because they all sell more than just, or most of them sell more than just pizzas, they sell other things. So what do they sell? What is the norm throughout the country? You can probably find, if you look hard enough, Google or Bing it, you'll be able to find out that some sell more than others, and some areas are better than others. So I'm going to have to go here in just a sec.
Okay.
But that's how you do it, and you'll be pretty, you'll be more accurate that way. But I am going to have to go. I've got people waiting for me.
Okay.
Okay. Right.
Professor, can you hold on? I'm going to ask the caller to hold on. Professor,
thank you
for your time. You did go over the time. I appreciate that. And everybody, again, make sure you tune in on Wednesday of next week. We'll be discussing. Professor, thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Caller, you still there?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for calling in. Question, have you listened to the show before?
No, uh-uh.
Okay. Well, there's an archive. Professor Geiger is a regular on the show. We've actually gone through his, and we're on chapter 8, and we're actually on principle number, I think we left off on principle number 63. So if you actually go through the archive, you'll see his shows, and we talk about a lot of different things. Again, we're on chapter 8, and I'll just give you an idea of some of the things we talked about. Principles for business and life, finding business opportunities, the business plan, he talks about that, how entrepreneurs view financial statements. That sounds like that would be a good chapter for you. Buying a business, legal and ethical issues, starting a business. I mean, so we've already covered some ground, and there might be some answers in some of those shows that, might help you. So I just want to invite you to...
Oh, okay, thanks. Can you give me his website?
TheRoadToTheTop.com.
Okay, thank you much.
Bye-bye. Okay, thank you so much for coming in. Everybody, thank you so much for your time. My special guest was Professor Joseph T. Geiger, author of the fabulous book, Entrepreneurial Success, 102 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. If you are starting a business, or if you are already in business, you definitely want to get this book. Again, the principles are not just for business, but the principles are for life as well. And for the small price of, what, $20 for the book, $19 for the book, you can save yourself a lot of headaches, a lot of time, and a lot of money. There's a way to do everything, okay? And if you look at successful ones, then they did something in a particular way that lended them towards the success that they're currently experiencing. Many small businesses fail within the first year. Why? A number of reasons. Maybe there were certain principles that they didn't adhere to. They just didn't know. When you're just starting in business, you need a mentor. You need somebody that's done it. They might not have done your particular business, but there are certain principles that are inherent in all businesses, certain principles that you need to have in order to be successful, certain principles that you need to enact in order to be successful. I'm recommending this book. I don't get anything if you buy this book. I don't get any kickbacks or anything like that. I'm recommending the book because I've read it. This is like third edition, and I've read all three. Excellent. Excellent. I don't just endorse people. I'm very, very careful when it comes to just endorsing certain things. But I'm endorsing this book because it's a good book, and I encourage you to get it. It's called Entrepreneurial Success, 102 Business Principles, The Road to the Top, by Professor Joseph T. Geiger. He's got over 50 years experience as an entrepreneur. He's been doing entrepreneurship, running businesses before many people, many of the listeners, were even born. Okay? So take advantage of the wisdom and, hey, get the book. Until the next time, everybody, I want to say thank you so much. My name is Jawanz, and I really appreciate your time. And again, Professor Geiger is going to be back on this Wednesday coming up. I believe that's what, November the 2nd? Let me make sure I got the date right. November the 3rd. No, let me take that back. Yeah, that's going to be November the 2nd, Wednesday, November the 2nd. And we're going to be talking about Finding a Career for Life. That's his new book. Okay, you can also save yourself a lot of time and money just by getting that book as well. Okay, so scroll down the archives, my brother, and check out the other shows. I think that you'll be glad that you did. If you're into spirituality, we've got shows with, oh my gosh, oh, where do I start? Let me start here. Shechem and Shechem, Ra and Nepha, Amen. He's Paramount King, not Paramount King. He's the Shechem and Shechem of the Osiriset Society. Awesome, awesome guest. I want you to check out his book. It's called Stress Free for Life. One of his books is called Stress Free for Life. We did a show on that. And you don't want to manage stress. Managing stress will kill you. You want to eliminate stress. Okay, scroll down the archives and listen to that show by Shechem and Shechem, Ra and Nepha, Amen. We've got shows with Orwa Hehimetu Ron Comics, Paramount King of the Washington, D.C. Region of the Osiriset Society. We just did a fabulous series on the seven divisions of the spirit. And we also did another great series on the 11 laws of God. We've got shows with Hekshem Suheru, Shechem Meyam Neter on the different solstices, the equinoxes and the solstices, on Minerv meditation. I mean, awesome, awesome shows with him. Brother Shechem, Tepraim Sa'az, then wonderful, wonderful shows on, I'm getting my terms mixed up here, Qigong. Thinking about the I Ching, but Qigong, awesome shows on that, family wellness as well. So you definitely want to check those shows out with him. Shechem Meta Uneta, then powerful, powerful shows with him on Qigong. So you want to scroll down and check out those shows. Everybody, I want you to get ready. Start now. You know we've got the winter solstice. We'll be here before you know it. Don't wait till it's upon you. Prepare for it. Matter of fact, in preparing for it, why don't you scroll down and check out a show that I did with Shechem Sa'anktaku Nenebu. Shechem Sa'anktaku Nenebu, great show on the winter solstice. Don't wait till it gets here. Prepare, start preparing your spirit now. Everybody, you know we're about to go into the Heru Kahuti cycle, so definitely prepare yourself for that as well. Everybody, I want to say thank you. Thank you for your feedback. Thank you for your time. Thank you for sharing the link, because by sharing the link, you can help other people too. And it's not about us, right? It's about us helping others as well. So until the next time, everybody, remember, I really, really appreciate you. My name is Jawanza. Who am I? I am the one who, in giving, receives more. Who are you?